Thank you very much, President Erika Carter, for this very kind and generous introduction. I am indeed very happy to be here, and I don't think that I don't think the fact that I'm very happy here has anything to do with me. I rather suggest that this is due to Warwick as such. and I hope that the relations between my university and Warwick will grow in the future. There are very indications of that kind. So first of all, I'm very grateful for this invitation. It is indeed a very great honor, and I'm very happy to be here. I too did not have the privilege of knowing Professor Chark, but from what I have gathered, he shared, as you quite rightly said, the same values that I would myself wish to subscribe to. And in the field of the humanities, I think that there was a great deal of commonality. So I consider the fact that you have asked me to come here as an honor, and I wish to pay tribute to the memory of Dr. Charlton. What I'm trying to do today is, in a sort of a wide-ranging way, touch upon some topics and some concerns around the area of heterogeneities and homogeneities. I think I should like to preface my statement by saying that since I see a few colleagues and friends who were there yesterday at the workshop, that there will be a regrettable overlap of some topics that we discussed yesterday. But I hope that you will bear with me. Allow me to start with a few general remarks, and that is that we seem to have come rather long way from the vision of a tolerant and a flexible society which could be characterized by cultural, experimental transformations, sort of a degree of hermeneutic openness, a distrust of rigidity or any kind of puritanical purity, and something which contained a society which had a vision which would carry forward some of the demands of the anti-colonial struggles of the past, and perhaps also some of the concerns which characterized the student movements of the 60s and 70s. Far from generating this kind of a creative, open society in which the recognition of difference becomes an integral part of the richness and plenitude of involved coexistence, today's liberal multicultural state has been shown, in fact, to move almost in the opposite direction. It nurtures rigid differences, it leads to a sedimentation of boundaries, and it becomes a helpless witness to alarming outbreaks of all kinds of violence, including racial violence. The context for my remarks is, of course, the crisis in societies which are undergoing rapid transition as a result of migrations, economic liberalization, and the growing disaffection with the nation state and its ability to solve crises of unemployment and the marginalization of large sections of the population, which then become, to some extent, expendable in the general drive towards future. The settled formula of earlier periods do not seem to work anymore, but we can at least say that what we are witnessing is the weakening of the gains of democracy out of the anti-colonial struggle, and are witnessing the spurious classification of the population into homogenized groups along ethnic, religious, linguistic lines, which in effect attacks the whole democratic project and forces us to remind ourselves once more that in fact the project of democracy, just as the project of modernity, is an unfinished project. The recent attacks on a Bengali, a Bangladeshi writer who was given exile in India, Taslima Nasreen, bears witness to this peculiar problem that exists in our tolerant societies today. She was exiled from Bangladesh because she in fact wrote a very courageous novel criticizing the authoritarian state and standing up for the rights of women. This was sufficient to make it impossible for her to live in Bangladesh. She was given a right of residence in Calcutta. As a result of various things which I will not go into right now, she was attacked again by fundamentalists in Calcutta, had to leave the city, was under conditions of deep secrecy transferred to Delhi or some other states in India, and now the question is whether she can live in India or whether the Indian state will, as it were, find a quiet solution of asking her to leave the country, because her presence in the country is a source of a problem. So this is what I mean when I say that the democratic project as an unfinished project leads to a situation of this kind in which a helpless state says, okay, I mean, we would like tolerance, but we would like it without any disturbance of the existing order. And this, I think, is the basic problem that we are dealing with. This is the background in order, and I say this because what I want to suggest is that the discussion of homogeneity and heterogeneity is to a large extent not merely a question of abstract cultural theory or abstract literary discussion, but in a sense is a problem which is very alive all over the world, and to come to terms with it is not a very easy thing. In other words, what we have is that today we are no longer in a position of what we were maybe about two or three decades ago, when we were fighting for the recognition of difference. That issue does not exist anymore. What you have is a struggle for who is going to represent the difference and who is going to be the representative of the difference. In other words, who can assert through a power struggle the right to say that I represent the difference and I am going to uphold this difference in the context of a power struggle, which is part of the modern state. So maybe we are very far from those interesting debates which we had about two decades ago on the question of tolerance and the recognition of difference as an act of humanity. We are now forced by circumstances, and as I suggested, probably because of the crisis of the society, economic crisis that we are going to understand that this is not the problem right now. The problem is how do you deal with a competitive force of multiple representatives who then have to apply themselves to the question of power in order to establish themselves. Now, instead of trying to place this in a paradigm which is a theoretical paradigm, I thought it may be interesting to go back to the fact that there's a common archive to which we can appeal if we wish to discuss these questions. And this archive is an archive which I suggest exists between Europe and India, with the explicit assumption, or I would say the explicit claim, that there is a shared history between Europe and India in which these problems were already thematized. Perhaps not very clearly, but there is a subterranean, what you might call, current of thematization of some of these problems in the context of the formation of nation states of Europe into something called Europe, and the emergence of India from its colonial domination through the anti-colonial struggle. So roughly, shall we say, in the last century, we have this common archive of problems which have articulated, sometimes not very clearly, sometimes only just as hints, but which all point to the fact that we are living, as it were, with an unfinished and uncompleted project of democracy, secularization, and what you might call the really tolerant society. I would like to suggest that in Europe itself, historical formations which were characterized by pluricultural communication, and by the way, here's a quick aside, pluricultural communication is communication in which we do not have boundaries defined on the basis of ethnicity or race or anything of that kind, whereas multicultural formations are one which recognize the fact that your ethnicity, your language, your difference is part of a mosaic. In other words, if you want to have an image, the multicultural society is a mosaic, whereas the pluricultural society does not have those straight borders, and in fact is a fluid, fuzzy kind of a concept of communication. What I want to suggest is that such efforts to have these plural situations in Europe failed. I mentioned yesterday in our workshop, the Habsburg Empire, in my opinion, was one of the few experiments within Europe of a pluricultural formation, and we all still remember what happened to Yugoslavia. As a result of the ideology of homogenization and the collapse of such pluricultural experiments, we have today, in fact, a situation in which there is a memory of such pluricultural formations in the context of Europe which has been formed, and the struggles of the Indian pluricultural state, like the Indian state, to retain whatever degree of heterogeneity was part of the promise of the anti-colonial struggle, faced by an increasing threat towards homogenization, a threat which is very real, and the reference to the Bangladeshi writer Taslim al-Nasreen was merely a reminder of the fact that this threat recently exists. I'm sure many of you know what happened many years ago with the destruction of the Babri Masjid Mosque and things of this kind. I will not go into that, but this reminder is at the back of my mind. Again, this question of the necessity of cultural autonomy is not something which is entirely new. It goes back to the period of the turn of the last century, around 1900, 1899, 1900, when Austro-Marxists strongly debated the question of cultural autonomy as the only way of retaining the multicultural nature of the Habsburg Empire. By granting cultural autonomy, it was fair to give to the people what they wanted, their linguistic, their cultural rights, but at the same moment to retain the question of having a state which is above these. And the criticism of this concept, and I think the criticism of this concept was that in fact by granting cultural autonomy, what you do is you destroy a secular project of common education. And the destruction of the secular project of common education means in fact that you are opening the possibility of various nation states establishing themselves. And within the establishment of the nation states as they exist, then you perpetuate the hierarchies that exist within these nation states instead of breaking down the hierarchies that exist. So that instead of cultural autonomy, the demand is solidarity across the various different cultures of a multicultural state along certain lines of conflict. These could be economic lines of conflict, so therefore the criticism of the cultural autonomy program of Austro-Marxists came from the other Marxists who say that in fact that this destroys the possibility of class struggle across cultures and so on and so forth. So what I wish to suggest is that many of these segregated, homogenized unit, which in themselves sound very convincing, and the argument for cultural autonomy in itself is quite a convincing argument, do not collapse if you at any stage suggest that there are transcending and lines of solidarity which are geared toward breaking down hierarchies which are not necessarily only cultural or only particular to a certain linguistic minority or a certain cultural minority, but which are embedded in larger systems of contradictions such as economic contradictions, but there are also many other contradictions. And in many ways I suggest that this is linked to our discussions in our field when we look at this archive, because because in this archive, then you read the text very differently in their struggle to come to terms with whatever symptoms of homogeneity are coming up and whatever symptoms of heterogeneity are being proposed and how people align themselves, sometimes with a great degree of ambivalence. You can find in these texts, and I think we discussed this briefly yesterday also, that the same author can be on one side, can be on the other side, depending on the situation. So I'm not trying to suggest that the archive that I'm appealing to gives me a very clear, defined picture of who stands where, but it gives me a large number of problems which I find are still present in our contemporary world. Having said this briefly, let me then suggest that if you will bear with me, that it is quite possible to suggest that between Europe and India we have a process going on which on the one hand is leading to a greater integration of relatively autonomous units into larger units. That's how I would call the process of Europe, which is an uncompleted process, that nation states gradually give up certain degrees of autonomy, certain degrees of their own rights in order to conform to some larger interest, larger political interest, larger social interest, which we call, for sake of as a hypothesis, Europe, the idea of Europe. So that the contradiction between the states as it existed before the Second World War, between different nation states, could then become submerged in a unit which is Europe, which can deal to in some extent with these contradictions. So this would be the process of Europe. When I say that these are largely smaller units and all that, I'm of course aware, as anybody else, that is that the nation state in Europe is itself a very differentiated concept. I mean, there's no such thing as the differences in Great Britain are very obvious, but in Germany they're equally obvious, between North and South, between various regions and all that. But nevertheless, for the sake of, as a hypothesis, I would say that the nation states of Europe do not have that degree of internal diversity and diversification which you would find, for instance, if you go to some African countries or for instance, if you go to India. So on the one hand, we have this process of what you might call subduing the power of the integral homogenized state in the interest of a larger unit such as Europe. And on the other hand, countries like India, which have to some extent a large degree of heterogeneity in terms of either race or ethnicity or language or whichever classificatory term you wish to use, are increasingly threatened by arguments which say that, you know, this is not a good thing, that this is not a natural order, it is an unnatural order, breaking it down into homogenized units or at least affirming the principle of homogenization is in fact the way in which the Indian state should exist. Now this problem is I think an acute problem, and to come to terms with this problem, one must also realize that in the process of the formation of Europe, many Europeans also realize that there are differences within Europe which make it difficult to discuss the problem without recognizing that European traditions themselves are very, very have a great degree of internal difference. Hungarian writer Peter Nagash has reflected on this very often and pointed out that Europe itself can command an experience, and I would call that experience in the linguistic terminology a competence, which divides Europe between those which had former colonial experience, and with that we refer to England, France, Spain, Portugal, and the Netherlands, and those countries, and that would be the Eastern European countries from whose point of view he's speaking, which do not have this experience, as a result of which the common Europe that is evolving has to come to terms with the lack, on one hand, of a common experience of the international colonized world, and on the other hand, the presence of this experience in certain parts of Europe, which leads to a different attitude to some situations of crisis. And he, at the time when he was writing it, he was referring to Yugoslavia as the crisis which existed in Europe, and how difficult it was to deal with this crisis for the Europeans in terms of the project of Europe. But I think that the same would also apply if we take the recent political occurrences in the world today and Europe's attitude to it. I point this out because Nagash is one of the few writers who writes as it were from the European periphery. Allow this term, which is not an unhappy term, to it, because he uses it himself, to point out that it is necessary to say that the knowledge of colonization and colonialism is integral to the formation of Europe as we know it today. And without knowing this, we do not realize what colonialism gave to Europe and how it will form its strength to it. This knowledge, of which I call this colonial competence, actually goes back to reflections on the various historical experiences that Europe had in the 18th century. And this experience has been formulated in philosophical terms, and I referred to that also yesterday, most cogently by Herder, because in Herder you have both ambivalence towards this as well as the clarity in which the problem is formulated. On the one hand, Herder is the one philosophical voice or one thinker who strongly emphasizes what you might call the teleology, or the teleological principle of the formation of Europe, which proceeds from a mixing of people, the coming together of very different races, very different ethnies in the process of amalgamation. He calls it amalgamation, but that this amalgamation is almost something which is out of physics. This amalgamation is unstable. This is as it were a compound which is unstable. It has to be resolved in order to arrive at the general spirit of Europe by creating natural order. And the only natural order which Herder, given his background of thought and the time at which he was writing, this natural order could only be the order which conforms to the plan of nature or to the plan of God. And the plan of God and the plan of nature, for him the only example for that was the family. And therefore the amalgamation of peoples can be broken down into natural units which correspond to a family. From there, I will cut short the detailed argument that he gives. From there, it was quite easy to say that the natural order for any coming together of people from various parts of the world together in one space is to affirm congruity of language, of race, of history, and of memory, and of territory. This, which was the birth of the nation state in Herder, was, however, and I think that's very important to realize, is based, however, on the recognition that without a chaotic amalgamation of people, you cannot have an organic unit, because the organic unit is a teleological result of the confusion that prevails. So in other words, as if it's a retelling actually of the history of creation, which Hadas bring, and that's very clear, that out of a tremendous chaos and out of a tremendous confusion, which is the mingling of people, you would have, as it were, the creation of an order by an act of God, in this case by an act of philosophical insight, which leads to a congruent, the affirmation of the organic congruency, and for this the criteria are the language, the people, the race, and the territorial unity based on a certain degree of memory, which, by the way, had in a very modern sort of a way, also looks upon as something that is constructed consciously. I mean, it's not that this memory is not something, he puts it into the act of actual conscious construction. So since nature produces families in order to ensure the survival of the species, the most natural order is that of an organic family, and that should have the transformation of this organic order to the nation is his concept of the nation. This, by the way, was exactly the point with which he criticized colonialism. Hadas' very strong criticism of colonialism is based on the insight that what the European powers are doing in the colonies is reproducing the wild intermingling of the spaces out of which they had emancipated themselves by creating national order. So they are, as it were, creating disorder. If you look at it in terms of physics, it is very clear, but they themselves, having evolved out of disorder into order, now are proceeding to create disorder elsewhere, as a result of which there is a confusion. Hadas, given his theological background and his personal preferences, located this very strongly in the history of very strongly in the problem of conversion, and his piece on Indian colonialism is actually an attack on the British question of conversion, and his opposition to conversion was precisely this form of interference. Now this interference is a very important point. So on the one hand, it's quite correct that he's opposing colonialism by saying that they're interfering, but at the same time, what he's doing is upholding the principle of what's known as in German, the Verstehende Distanz, a distance derived from understanding. And the perpetuation of the distance derived from understanding is the basis of the liberal theory of tolerance, is do not interfere, leave them to do their own job on their own. In other words, let the hierarchies resolve themselves on their own. This is very different from Hegelian or historical perspectives, which says that we must historicize the whole problem so that it is clear that there are no rigid hierarchies which exist anywhere, but the internal possibilities of dissolving themselves is given through acts of solidarity, acts of supporting somebody elsewhere, acts of affirming that one shares the same values. Here, Hadas' point is to, as it were, a kind of a withdrawal on the basis of a principle of tolerance, which, by the way, as for Germanists is very important to realize, is also the basis of his indubitably very important task of rescuing the literatures of East Europe in his Stimmen der Völkerten, the collection of songs, which was for him a task of rescuing, and this is his own words, which was rescuing people without history and by taking them over into history. So Eric Wolff's famous book, People, Europe and the People Without History, actually is a quote from Hadas, who talks of the geschichtslosen Völker, the people without history, coming to history as a result of his rescuing, but on the principle of allowing them at the same time their complete autonomy of freedom to develop. So this question of order and disorder is very important, and this is very peculiarly also there in Hadas' attitude towards the Jews. And I would like to just label this point a little bit, please. Excuse me for doing so, because I think that it is important. On the one hand, Hadas starts with the reflection on the Jews as an alien people of Asiatic origin, whose loyalties are transnational. He says that they subscribe to a law which is not a European law, which is a law which belongs to something outside Europe. Then he points out that the Jews themselves consider themselves as exceptional and different, and therefore treating them in the same way as treating us would in fact be against their own interests. Now, but he takes it a step further, and therefore the question is not of discussing Jewish culture or Jewish or things connected with the Jewish law. The question is only of saying that this is a matter, this is a Staatsfrage, it's a question of a matter of state. And he says, we have to arrive at a position in which the alien Jew can be treated in the same way, and I quote, as the Chinese or the Indians or the Persians or the Gypsies or the Turks would be treated if they were coming to Europe. I mean, he foresaw what is happening today 200 years ago. In order to treat them in this manner, what is this required is that they are not excluded from the national educational enterprise of the modern state, and through this they become contributors to the culture of these states as a result of what is known as Bildung. So in a sense, what he's asking for at this level is that we have a Leitkultur, as the Germans would say, or we have a certain form of Deutschheit or Germanness, or maybe some other kind of ness through which this assimilation is possible. This, as Hannah Arendt in A Critique of Herder has pointed out, is actually a double move. On the one hand, he denies to the Jews a specific position in Europe and dehistoricizes them. So that is, as it were, he dehistoricizes their move to of legitimizing themselves on the basis of history, and says that if they are able to carry their Palestina everywhere with them, as it were, as a portable Palestina, their integration to the secular European world would become possible. This, on the one hand, is a move away from the Lessing's notion of tolerance, because Lessing's notion of tolerance towards the Jews was based on the fact of asking them to be, or demanding that they be recognized as humans. But also the same way in which many of us have said they are also human beings and therefore treat them as equal. This also is the key word there. So Lessing's position is that. But Herder's position is different. He first ascribes a special exceptional position to the alien people, in this case the Jews, incorporates them as a distinct people in the whole culture of mankind, after all concepts through which their special position could be defined have been destroyed, absorbing them into the notion of Bildung and creating a position of Verstehende Distanz to them. This understanding distance is result of a dehistoricization process which nevertheless, however, grants to them a position in the society which is then negotiable, in the sense in which I started off my reflection, is negotiation, because it gives us the possibility of demanding that they elect a representative who represents them in the situation of a society based on this new kind of tolerance, as opposed to the general humanistic tolerance which was I would say the position of Lessing and people of that kind. In a sense, what Herder is trying to do is to suggest that tolerance is the privileged position from which we do not discover the humanity of any alien people, but we rather move to a situation where we understand uniqueness in and its changes, and therefore uphold the position of a distanced understanding of uniqueness. Now, and this, as I said, is very similar to the Jewish colonialism. Now, this is very different from how Goethe and Humboldt looked upon the question of tolerance. Goethe, in fact, in a way, theoretically, and the way in which I characterize Goethe's move is an anti-hermeneutical move, or if you do not like this rather strong term, anti-hermeneutical, let us at least agree on saying as an a-hermeneutical move. Of saying, and the Humboldt follows him in this regard also, is that the question in society is not of understanding, the question in society is only of determining what equality is. And therefore the demand that Goethe made in his unsystematic reflections on difference and tolerance and on education and Bildung, and all this is part of Makarian's archive, is that we cannot claim that society will give us freedom. What we, however, can demand is society gives us equality. Freedom is something which we have to bring with ourselves. Mm-hmm. This is a completely ahermeneutical way of putting the question, because it lies the question of understanding completely. What is therefore required is establishing that equality takes place in society and leaves the question of understanding each other completely takes it away completely out of the picture, and suggests that what is more important than understanding is find ways of getting along with each other. And this pragmatic move in Goethe, and this is a surprisingly pragmatic move in Goethe, and I call it an ahermeneutic move, is what you might call the lost part of the history of European tolerance, lost part of the history of European reflections on tolerance, I want to put it more carefully, the recovery of which is only possible if we realize what the pitfalls of the concept of tolerance actually involves, if we claim that a society has to be based on equality. If a society has to be based on equality, it is the position is not that I try say that, yes, I understand you, but you are allowed to have your difference, and therefore you please look after yourself. The question is, how do I create a pragmatic situation of pluricultural communication? This is how I talk about pluricultural communication, in which the equality of the ability to communicate is given by society and is not, as it were, covered up by the fact that, yes, of course we understand you, but please do not disturb us. That Whereas on the contrary, this attitude says that you are equal and this equality is guaranteed, and then maybe at some later stage the question of what understanding is can be taken up. So I've tried to say that what Goethe and this tradition of ahermeneutic thinking is a form of hermeneutic abstinence. For some time at least it says that we relegate the question of understanding to a moment in history when society itself will have reached the utopian possibilities of bringing together equality and understanding without creating difference. So this move towards the utopian side is, I think, what can be taken as the heritage of the classical German heritage, the way I have tried to interpret it from Goethe onwards. As a project of emancipation, as an emancipatory project, also again an unfinished project, emancipatory, secular, democratic project, and which is then the basis of the concept of world literature as Goethe formulated it in his various jottings and stray remarks, etc. World literature as a process, not as something as a history of the great canon or the grand canon or the big books and all that, but as a process of arriving in a situation through the commerce, he talks of commerce all the time, and of commerce, and that's why Marx quoted these passages from Goethe when he took over the concept of world literature, through commerce as an internationalization, because the existing nation states as they're given to us today are not internally in a position to reach that stage of emancipation through which all the promises of literature could be fulfilled. That is only possible in a utopian, internationalized, planetarized world, in which then world literature would come into its own. There's slight Hegelianism in this, but that doesn't matter. This concept of world literature, interestingly enough, was taken up in the Indian context by Tagore. His term Vishnu Sahitya was directly related to Goethe's concept of world literature. And I think what is happening today, at least that's my impression, and not by the way, I'm not a Tagore scholar by any means. What is happening today is a reassessment of Tagore's enormously interesting political writings. For a long time, these writings were not really taken very seriously. Tagore was, of course, the great thinker, the great writer, the Nobel Prize winner, the fount of Indian wisdom, and so on and so forth. But the fact that he was a very acute observer of political transformation of Indian society, of the colonial movement, is not very often realized. Shall we say not enough often realized in Europe, because the translations are then of a kind that emphasize the poetry, the whatever else, the wisdom, and so on and so forth. But the very important political essays that he wrote on and criticism of Indian society are not so well known, at least that's my impression, at least in Germany. They may probably be known in Britain. But in the context of the Indian anti-colonial struggle, Tagore was very, very clearly conscious of two facts. First of all, or let me put it this way. He wrote in 1919 that India's problem was the problem of the world in miniature. On the one hand, India is too vast in its area and too diverse in its races. It is many countries packed in one geographical receptacle. It is just the opposite of what Europe truly is, namely one country made into many. It's an interesting observation. But what Tagore was concerned with was that the anti-colonial struggle combined two emancipatory movements. One was the struggle against external bondage, and that would be the anti-colonial struggle. The other was the struggle against the internal bondage of caste within the Indian subcontinent. So freedom was emancipation from two kinds of bondages. One was external, that was colonialism. The other one was internal, and that was to develop a liberating heterogeneity within India, which was, as it were, imprisoned by a restricted homogeneity of class structure and of the impossibility of moving between these given differences. And therefore he claimed that the anti-colonial struggle had the task of achieving that difficult unity which has to be true in spite of the separateness that is dear. This rather ambiguous formulation is actually based on his notion that India's disjointed heterogeneity is lumbering in an unrhythmic stagger towards a freedom. This disjointed heterogeneity, which is lumbering towards towards freedom, was in fact this clash between heterogeneity and homogeneity that he was very to be aware of. His own solution of universalism, or his own attempt to have a pedagogical university, a pedagogische Provinz, as it were, in Shantiniketan, were probably unrealistic. But that is not my point. The point is that that Tagore, in his own cosmopolitan anti-national attitude and with all its romantic anti-capitalism, nevertheless denies the possibility of suggesting that the anti-colonial struggle and the internal struggle against the homogenization forces in India were linked together, as against the fundamentalist program of saying that the freedom from colonialism in India would only be possible if the various religious communities in India were given the freedom to organize themselves as a political force on their own, and against a secular program in which religion would not be the decisive moment of creation of a state. Now, as we know, that the fundamentalist movement, which was always part of the Indian anti-freedom anti-colonial struggle, lost out in the process of a secular formation based largely on Nehru and Gandhi's own interests, a secular formation which affirmed that the future free India would be a secular India, a democratic India. But this did not mean that the theoretical drive behind fundamentalism lost out. On the contrary, it was very strongly prevalent and continued to exist very strongly, and its basic notion of the concept of future India based on a natural order was very similar to what was being evolved by theoreticians of the 30s and 40s in Germany, especially Carl Schmitt's notion of what is called substantive natural order, especially in his Verfassungslehre, of the homogeneity of the folk and not of humanity. The secular order, with all its fuzzy, unclear, also not very stringent conceptualization of humanism and so on and so forth, could not compete with this very strongly argued out notion of a conceptually strong notion of a homogeneity of folk, of people, as the basis of the relationship between the ruled and the ruled. The homogeneity of the people was not an abstract concept just for the homogeneity. It was a question of how you structure power relationships between the ruler and the ruled, and therefore the Verfassungslehre of Carl Schmitt had to define what are the subjects of the state. Who are the subjects of the state? And the subjects of the state were not this amorphous group of people from various religions, various races, etc. That could not be the state. The state would have to be a homogenized order, which means, by definition, and this I think is quite obvious, means creating a system of exclusion and inclusion. Because excluding from the homogenized order, you exclude whatever you do not consider part of what is called the folk. And defining the folk is then very very different. It is quite possible that in Europe the folk is defined differently from what the folk is defined in India. You may have as a marker religion in one place which you do not emphasize in another place. In another place you may define skin color as the marker for homogeneity, but not necessarily religion. So this entire flexibility of what markers you put into the question of homogeneity is actually part of the power of this notion of homogeneity, why it appeals to people. You can use it, but you can fill it up differently from time to time. And therefore, and from this derives this this Indian concept, which corresponds to further other abstractions, Hindutva, just as Britishness or Germanness or Deutschheit, and so on and so forth, is actually a system of exclusion and inclusion, because it then says that whoever is not part of this ness is actually somebody who's a minority, or who comes from some other place, whose loyalties lie elsewhere. And this notion of minority brings us back to this notion of tolerance. Because the minorities, especially in the ways in which was formulated by Savarkar and other ideologues of fundamentalism, were not necessarily going to be, at least not theoretically, they were not necessarily going to be subject to some system of force. They would be tolerated provided they accepted their position as minorities. The toleration meant they would be given their own specific rights as minorities. They would then be allowed to elect their representatives, who would then be part of a system of democratic governance in which, as minorities, they would have the rights to be to become minorities. But they would lose out in the larger project of being equals in a secular democratic state. And so I think this is this is the point through which homogeneity gains both its force as a theory, but also its what you might call destructive potential. For what you might call the weaker notion of a secular democratic society, which, as I have suggested, is actually a fragile notion, because it is strongly dependent on the existence of very institutions which are functioning very well and very strongly. It is very easily disrupted. It requires a larger degree of awareness of what it means to be a citizen, and all these other things which I will, for the time being, perhaps leave out. Now, in order to, I must have a look at the time also, don't overstep the limits. But this is also one of the reasons why the question of Islam and Muslim identity and so on and so forth in India has a colouring which is not necessarily the same as in Europe. Because the demand of the Muslims from a position of a majority to prove that they are, as it were, worthy of being members of the Indian state comes from the position of strength, which puts them in the difficult position of having to justify their own movement towards secularism or any kind of modernism as something that takes place under the threat of them being excluded from the general principle of the state's largesse. And this is something which, for instance, a very fascinating Muslim thinker in India, whose name is not well known here, Khundiri, has repeatedly in his writings emphasized that Islam has the potential in India, as you know, Sufism, syncretism, and all these traditions are available, but it is under the explicit command, as it were, the majority to be a minority which is aware of the fact that it is tolerated as a minority, and others to be aware that it is a minority, it then closes ranks and allows itself to fall into precisely the role that is designed for it, maybe to elect its own representatives, who then become the people who attack the Srimana Srim because she is then writing against the conservative order. So this I suggest, is part of the history of toleration and tolerance and toleration, as opposed to what I would call the Goethean ahermeneutical principle of emphasizing equality as the one factor which is required in the modern society, and at least to make us aware of the ambiguity or the ambivalence of the otherwise very noble term, tolerance, because that is a term we use everywhere in our institution. We must tolerate opinions and so on and so forth. But I think that while doing so, we must be also aware of what the larger implications of this would be. Now let me come very briefly. I reached this point on the basis of my assumption that what we are talking about actually, when we talk about tolerance and equality, is the difference between two kind of social orders, for which we have a very good terminology which goes back to the sociologist Tönnies, the difference between Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. So actually what Goethe's argument leads to is the notion of Gesellschaft in the form of a society, whereas the tolerance argument from Herder onwards, etc., moves towards a Gemeinschaft, as a community. So the community versus the society is in fact, to my mind, at least for the sake of argument, what corresponds to the question of a liberal tolerance with the notion of minority rights, as against the indifference to tolerance, but the affirmation, strong affirmation of equality, which would arise out of the arguments given by Goethe. So in other words, the multicultural, pluricultural state and the pluricultural society is in fact a society, whereas the multicultural order is a coalition of communities, which then have to find their relationships to each other on the basis of different power equations or different negotiations which take place in terms of power. Now, what sort of a cultural theory can we then appeal to if we say that there is a contradiction between heterogeneity and homogeneity? And since all, as I mentioned yesterday, and this is one of the overlaps with yesterday, all our theories are based on metaphors which we derive from various other disciplines, from botany, from physics, from mathematics, etc. We talk of roots, we talk of fuzziness, we talk of so many other things which are all taken from everywhere else. And or from other histories and other disciplines. Now I think that in this archive I'm appealing to, we have, interesting enough again, the possibility of saying that larger formations like Europe or India cannot be adequately grasped with metaphors which are unidimensional. Victor Hugo in the 19th century spoke of Europe as a palimpsest. This is a term Jawaharlal Nehru used for India in his discovery of India. India is a palimpsest. So what is a palimpsest? This is a very attractive notion, but it's a notion which has not been taken to the level of theoretical, you know, sophistication. It is a metaphor. It means that a palimpsest, something which exists as a system of overwriting, but with a claim that each of these overwritings are justifiable in their own self. So any form of erasure of anything which has been written in order to reach some sort of an authentic base is actually an erasure which leads to a complete tabula rasa. The result of reaching authenticity in a palimpsest is actually zero. It is the blank sheet of paper or the blank parchment, which means actually it's a metaphor which is against violence. Because the palimpsestic order, which is an order of history, Europe, according to Hugo, is a palimpsestic order. Nehru, without knowing Hugo's writings, I'm sure, used this term, which he took from De Quincey, if I know correctly. De Quincey talks also of palimpsest in terms of, you know, theory of brain and memory. And Nehru got it from there. But this palim exists. So this palimpsestic order is the order of all civilizations which come under large states, large multinational, multicultural, pluricultural, whichever at this point it doesn't matter what you call it, but which are large. The defense of large states such as Europe and India was integral to the part of the anti-colonial project, because the small nation state was always a state which was not going to provide us with a secular order unless it could be something like Weimar, but that was one moment in history. So the large order was defended. Now this large order is a palimpsestic order. The struggle for authenticity in a palimpsestic order, which is given by the forces of homogeneity such as Hindutva in India or fascism in Europe, was the attempt to make an erasure of all the accumulated, what you might call, debris of history, which as such is civilization. And therefore the archaeological impulse of digging deep in order to find authenticity and to find what was actually there before somebody else came to build something over it is an impulse which goes against the palimpsestic order. There's a difference between digging deep in order to celebrate the writing of so many things over something else, and the difference between the discovering how much there is, how rich something is. There's a difference between this and the desire to say that it is now that we have found what was originally there, and therefore everything else loses its value. These two differences are the strongest differences which make archaeology actually a key science for theory of culture today in many ways. By the way, this is not only Nehru. Another distinguished scholar in India, Kosambi, whose name is probably not so well known, also spoke of India as a country of long histories and long survivals which exist in history. Now, as I've already mentioned, that therefore if the root is not a good metaphor, if the palimpsestic order is a good way of looking at things, then what could we replace root with? And that's, I think, all of you have done cultural theory, know that that is the result. The Deleuze and Guattari's notion of the rhizomatic order. In other words, something where you can never say what is the original root, but which is a heterogeneous flowering of many, many ways of implanting itself spread across a surface, so that everything, as it were, is connected with everything else. It is, as Deleuze himself or Guattari and Deleuze both say, it relentlessly creates heterogeneity. Now, there is internal impulse in this plant, which is a rhizomatic, which is a rhizome or a rhizome, is to relentlessly create heterogeneity because it strikes roots everywhere. In other words, it is a subversive plant. It is against the strict and honorable growth of the single tree. And here again, interestingly enough, when Tagore was asked what he was looking for in order to oppose the Ur text, which would be the only Ur text, he wrote in lines, "I would rather insist on the inexhaustible variety of the human race, which does not grow straight up like the palm tree on a single stem, but like the banyan tree, spreads itself with ever new trunks and ever new branches." This was an interesting thing. And linked to this also questions of purism, of the question of into which I will not go, I will not deal with that today. The question of affirmation of multiple, many languages, of the ability to exist simultaneously in multiple languages, to have multilingualism as something which is desirable, as something which can be affirmed, against the question of saying that the substantive way in which a human being achieves his own or her own identity or her own fulfillment is only through the recognition of this one language through which one actually finds one's way and one's relationship to the external world. The fact that you can do it through many languages is one of the consequences of a heterogeneous theory of culture as against a homogenized theory of culture, which then again in the spirit of tolerance says, of course many languages are there, then they should exist, but they should be, the relationship between them is negotiated. And this principle of negotiation of difference in language is the basis of two different theories of translation. The one theory of translation, which you might call the classical theory of translation, takes each language as a bounded unit through which an expert culture establishes itself in order to make the two bounded systems of language intelligible to each other. Whereas the heterogeneous notion of a theory of translation is very much so in the way in which Benjamin looked at it, is a way of affirming the possibility of mutation and mutability and verwandlung in that sense between languages in order to derive ever new kinds of texts in which the presence of many languages is there, although they are articulated in one language. That is the basic difference of these two theories of translation. And this is also, I'm repeating myself, and this is also the difference between writing which emerges out of the atmosphere of many languages, such as in India, or such as also in other, such as was the case in the Donau Monarchy, of writing which emerges out of these languages, although it is written in one language, whether it is in Hindi, or whether it is in German, or whether it is in English of India, there is the simultaneous presence of the atmosphere of all the other silent voices and languages, which are nevertheless very much part of the articulation, although it is in one language. Now, this is what I would say is the crucial difference. Allow me then to come to a conclusion, provisional conclusion, which would be roughly this: that in all these notions, we have, of course, the question of territory and space being articulated itself, whether it is in questions of order or in questions of negotiation. And relooking at the notion of space is a very important part of contemporary cultural theory. And here there's an alliance between geography and cultural theory, which has become fairly obvious over the last 15 to 20 years. All this again goes back to the archive I was interested in. Because one of the most important theoreticians of the question of what space can mean is Ernst Bloch, who in the concept of the simultaneity of the non-synchronous actually captured many of the problems that I'm trying to struggle with. His own reflections are based on his criticism of Spengler and Spengler's cultural theory, which he formulated in his analysis of fascism. In a book which I think is still really worth reading, The Heritage of Our Times, Erbschaft dieser Zeit, in which he criticized Spengler's cultural theory in the decline of the West, Unterganges Abendlandes, as an accumulation of numerous internally ordered gardens of the soldiers. So each garden has its own rights. As against this form of what he called the geographismus, which he called geographism of Spengler, Bloch was arguing for an elastic concept of space and time, which would allow us to break away from this coexistence principle of various gardens of culture. Because the fundamental problem that Spengler and many other theoreticians of culture faced at that time was that they did not know how to incorporate in the teleological principle of the formation of Europe as the highest point of culture, which moves as it were from ancient Egypt, Babylon, Greece, etc. to modern Europe. They did not know how to fit into this teleological movement towards Europe the existing cultures of the East, notably for Spengler, India and China, or shall we say Asia in general. This they could only do by, as it were, allowing them to coexist, as this is Bloch's formulation, allowing these Asian cultures to coexist with Europe without communication as cultures. In other words, in their own cultural autonomy project of their own specificity, of their own difference, and with a great deal of respect. I mean, Spengler, who had studied the German Indology very carefully, realized also that the German Indology was the one which rescued India's culture and Indology and the manuscripts, etc., etc., from oblivion, and had restored to them a certain respect, but by affirming that they are completely different, and therefore they do not fit into the teleology of Europe. So they were in what modern anthropologists or students of ethnology have learned to say, they belong to a different time. They were not part of our time. And this distancing through time, the allochronic principle, as I think Fabian calls it, the allochronic principle, was inherent to Spengler's notion of cultural theory, which was criticized by Ernst Bloch in his Heritage of the Time as this something which had to be countered by elastic notion of space and time in order to overcome the rigidity of this geographism. The new dialectical space of time, which of course neither Spengler nor many of those who accept his criticism of Spengler have been able to really develop very much so, is to say that cultural theory is the choice between cultural monads, as windowless monads which exist each other with their own rights, and a multiversum. As a universe, instead of universe, as a multiversum of culture which is strongly interconnected all the time. And this interconnection anticipates in many ways our contemporary notions of shared history, connected history, of connected history. So that this history is always a history of continuous mediation between man and labor spread over the geographical space of history. Now this is a formulation which is not exactly the same as saying that we are all one and we are all going the same thing, but it's said that instead of a geographism of monadism which divides us into cultural monads, what we have is a movement of mediation between time and space spread over territories which is our planet, and which has then to be understood as interconnected. This interconnected time-space dynamic, time-space theory of gleichzeitigkeit, of simultaneity, is and also, in my opinion, a metaphor which we cannot put into two-dimensional terms and say that this is a monad against a monad. It requires a different way of conceptualizing what you might call the interacted nature or the interconnected nature of the development of culture through history, through contradiction over time and space as a multiversum, rather than as something which is developed in one part of the world and in some other part of the world and then negotiated towards an agreement as a result of a question of power relations. Now this fascinating notion of which is now almost become a phrase which is quoted everywhere and has lost much of its what you might call explosive nature which it had in the 30s, it has become a commonplace now, is one way of reviving the concept of what that he calls the unfinished humanum of history. And unfinished humanum of history, which is that the Western concept of progress implied in its revolutions no European world. And of course, he adds as a footnote, but also no Asian world and also no African world. So this humanum, transferred as interconnected history, is opposed to ethnic absorption of the process of liberation through history, as it were, in absorption, by not granting to it any location as either European or Asian or African, putting it back into the humanum, but humanum not necessarily understood in the concept of one mankind in that sense, but humanum as an unfinished project. So Bloch's entire philosophy of the noch nicht sein, of the not yet being, of humanity not having come into existence, of the liberated society not having as yet come into existence, is based on the notion that existing theories of culture, which were based on the homogenization concept and on the basis of tolerance, in fact did not come to term, or which were either or teleological in principle, did not deal with this very simple fact that history has yet not come to an end. And all cultural theory deals with history as though it has completed itself in some project or the other. So the unfinished project of history, the unfinished project of modernity, the unfinished project of secular democracy are all interconnected if we look at the problem in the context of competing models of heterogeneity and homogeneity, which I think are dominating in the world and are still dominating in the world today. I think I'll close.